Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am covering in this audio Leviticus chapter 6, verses 1 through 30, the entire chapter. I'm going to call this chapter Miscellaneous Laws Concerning the Guilt Offering, the Burnt Offering, the Grain Offering, and the Sin Offering. Our context is this. In our last chapter, chapter 5, we talked about sin offerings and guilt offerings and the confusion between the two and how difficult it is to distinguish the two. But we tried. So now we start in verses 1 through 5 of Leviticus 6. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "When a person sins and acts unfaithfully against the Lord and deceives his companion in regard to a deposit or a security entrusted to him, or through robbery, or if he is extorted from his companion, or has found what was lost and lied about it and sworn falsely, so that he sins in regard to any one of the things a man may do, then it shall be, when he sins and becomes guilty, that he shall restore what he took by robbery, or what he got by extortion, or the deposit which was entrusted to him, or the lost thing which he found, or anything about which he swore falsely. He shall make restitution for it in full, and add to it one-fifth more. He shall give it to the one to whom it belongs on the day he presents his guilt offering." Guilt offering, of course, that's the King James American Standard Version, New American Standard translation of trespass offering. It's considered one of the major types, assuming it's distinct from the sin offering, it's one of the major types of the offerings for which, in any case, a ram was offered, a male sheep. You'll notice the one-fifth, the 20% restitution for this property crime. That's typical of a trespass offering. You have to make restitution plus pay 20%. So we're talking about here a guilt offering. Now, what kind of sin precipitated this guilt offering? Well, it's a sin against another person's property. You can deceive him in regard to a deposit or a security. In other words, you take the security and then you don't give it back to him when that which was pledged is done. Or you, through robbery, you just steal something from somebody. Or if you've extorted something from your companion, for example, "Give me your prize bull. I'm going to tell everybody that you've been sleeping around on your wife." That would be extortion. Or has found what was lost and lied about it. You know, there's an old maxim that everybody says, finders, keepers, losers, weepers. Well, I hate to tell you, that wasn't true in Roman law. It's definitely not true in American law or English common law. You find something that's lost, you are the bailor. And the loser of the property is the bailee, and a bailor is required to guard that property with due care and diligence and then return the property when the loser of the property has been located. Well, if somebody doesn't do that, well, then he's guilty of a property crime here in verse 3. Or that he sins in regard to any one of the things a man may do, and of course that's a little bit confusing, a confusing NASB translation. The NIV says if he commits any such sins as people may do, in other words, relating to property, any kind, and of course you can extrapolate from this to any kind of property crime that you do against your neighbor, you make restitution and you add 20%, one-fifth more. Why the extra one-fifth? Well, that's to keep people from just stealing something. You get caught, okay, well, I'll return it. What have you lost? Nothing. The thief loses nothing. You got to make him pay for what he did. And it's also a good deterrent. People know if they steal something and have to return it plus 20%, they're less likely going to steal. Now in verse 5, it says that the restitution should be done on the same day that the guilt offering is presented. Question then arises, well, what happens first? Do you restore the property first and then offer your guilt offering, or offer the guilt offering first and then restore the property? I don't know. I don't think it matters. They both need to be done. Now notice in verse 1 that the Lord spoke to Moses. We're still in the front of the tabernacle where Moses is, and God is in his Shekinah glory cloud talking to Moses, giving him all these Levitical laws. This goes way back to the first of the book. More and more, or there are many, many passages which start out this way. Then the Lord spoke to Moses. It's at the same time during that encounter between Moses and the Lord. And notice in verse 2, the Lord tells Moses, when a person sins and acts unfaithfully against the Lord. Well, how do they act unfaithfully against the Lord? By stealing one of their companion's property or violating their neighbor's property rights? Because a sin against a human is a sin against the Lord. The idea that you're supposed to return lost property, it's not finders, keepers, losers, weepers. You got to return the lost property. We see that in Deuteronomy 22, verses 1 through 3. You shall not see your countryman's ox or his sheep straying away and pay no attention to them. You shall certainly bring them back to your countrymen. If your countryman is not near you, or if you do not know him, then you shall bring it home to your house, and it shall remain with you until your countryman looks for it, then you shall restore it to him. Thus you shall do with his donkey, and you shall do the same with his garment, and you shall do likewise with anything lost by your countryman, which he has lost and you have found. You are not allowed to neglect them. That is a perfect ancient statement of the common law for bailors. You're supposed to guard the property with due care. We go now to Leviticus 6, verses 6 and 7. Then he shall bring to the priest, that's the thief, or the converter of property, he shall bring to the priest his guilt offering to the Lord. Again, this is a guilt offering. KJV says trespass offering. It's not a sin offering, it's a guilt offering. He shall bring it to the Lord, a ram without defect from the flock. Well, we see the 20% and the ram. Those two things tip you off real quick. We're talking about a guilt offering. Without defect from the flock, all sacrifices were without defect. Of course, you don't give God junk. According to your valuation for a guilt offering. Now, the valuation was either the valuation of the value of the property converted from the innocent neighbor, and I believe that's what it was, or it could be the proper valuation for a ram. It has to be a ram of 2 shekels, according to Gill. I think that's rabbinic. I think it's easier just to say it's the valuation of the crime, because you need to know that so you can take 20% of it. And the priest shall make atonement for him before the Lord, and he will be forgiven for any one of the things which he may have done to incur guilt. Now, the law of the guilt offering is given initially in Leviticus 5, 17 through 18 in the last chapter. If someone sins and without knowing it violates any of the Lord's commands concerning prohibited, he bears the consequences of his guilt. Now, this is for an unknowing sin, but the guilt offering covered both unknowing sin and intentional sin, because I failed to mention it here. When you take somebody's property or keep somebody's property that you know belongs to him and you don't return it, or you extort somebody or you rob somebody, that is not an unintentional crime, folks. That is intentional as it can be. And this is clearly a trespass offering because of the 20%, because of the ram being offered. And so that proves that trespass offerings covered intentional sins as well as unintentional sins. Because we see here in Leviticus 5, 17 through 18 concerning the guilt offering, if someone sins and without knowing it, unaware, violates any of the Lord's commands concerning anything prohibited, he bears the consequences of his guilt. He must bring an unblemished ram, there's your trespass offering, from the flock according to your assessment of its value as a restitution trespass offering. So, there's a myth out there that Old Testament sacrifices could not cover intentional sins, and it's a myth, and it's repeated over and over again. I unfortunately repeated it in one of my earlier audios. I need to take a sin offering to the Lord and say, I sinned, I screwed up, I shouldn't have said that. It's not true. Now, when it says this guilt offering should be brought to the Lord, of course, that means to the tabernacle of the Lord, because that's where the Lord dwelled, in the Holy of Holies. We go down to Leviticus 6, verses 8 through 10. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the law for the burnt offering. Now, we're moving now from the guilt offering to the burnt offering. The burnt offering itself shall remain on the hearth on the altar all night until the morning. Now, we're talking about a specific burnt offering, the evening and morning sacrifices that the Jewish priest kept burning on the altar 24/7. The burnt offering itself shall remain on the hearth on the altar all night until the morning, and the fire on the altar is to be kept burning on it. The priest is to put on his linen robe, and he shall put on undergarments next to his flesh, and he shall take up the ashes to which the fire reduces the burnt offering on the altar and place them beside the altar. Now, Aaron and his sons, that's always a little confusing to me. Does it mean Aaron and the descendants that come after him after Aaron dies? Well, right here, no, I think it's Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and Eleazar and Ithamar, the 4 sons of Aaron. They're all consecrated at the same time, and they're responsible for, at their various times when they were high priests, to maintain the burnt offering morning and evening. Now, the burnt offering required a lamb plus a grain offering. We read that in Numbers 28, verses 3 through 5. And say to them, this is the fire offering you are to present to the Lord. Each day present 2 unblemished year-old male lambs as a regular burnt offering. Offer 1 lamb in the morning and the other lamb at twilight, along with 2 quarts of fine flour for a grain offering mixed with 1 quart of olive oil from crushed olives. 2 quarts is 1/10 of an ephah, which is the same thing as an omer. You see that a lot in the other translations that don't switch it to English units. So grain and olive oil and a lamb every morning, every night. Now this lamb was to be burned all night long, as it says in verse 9. Now, Adam Clark's got an interesting idea here. He says if you put a burnt offering on the altar all at once and just left it, it probably wouldn't last the night. So Clark speculates that the priest probably sat up all night and fed the offering slowly to the fire. And then the same was probably done about the morning sacrifice. Well, I don't know. You can have a fire down low and let it simmer all night. It wouldn't surprise me that a lamb could last the whole night. So I don't know if Clark's right about that, but I do know this. It was 24/7 in the morning and the night. The burnt offering just kept right on burning. There never was a time when the smoke of a burnt offering wasn't going up to God. And of course, a burnt offering symbolized the entire, complete, 100% dedication and consecration to God by the offeror. In this case, the offeror is the people of Israel because the burnt offering represented the whole people. So 24/7, the people saying, "We're yours, God." The NIV Study Bible puts it this way. The continuously burning burnt offering showed uninterrupted offering to God. It represented uninterrupted appeals to God on behalf of Israel. Okay, that's what I'm saying. Just, I'm yours 100% of the time. We're yours, the people of Israel. Now, the priest is said to have to put undergarments on while he puts the burnt offering on the altar. Why? Well, actually, this is when he goes outside to dump the ashes next to the altar. I guess he already is outside because he's putting the lambs on the altar. But the reason he's supposed to wear undergarments is so his private parts aren't exposed, because then he would be indecent. He shall take up the ashes to which the fire reduces the burnt offering on the altar and place them beside the altar. There was a place beside the altar where the burnt offering ashes were put. That was to the east of the bronze altar. The ashes were put to the east. The burnt offerings and other offerings, sin offerings, were slain to the north of the altar. To the east of the altar is where the ashes went. We read in Leviticus 1:16, "He will remove its digestive tract," this is a burnt offering, "cutting off the tail feathers, and throw it on the east side of the altar at the place for ashes." Now, there was a two-stage removal of the ashes. First, the ashes were removed to the east side of the altar, and then later, the ashes were taken from the altar outside the courtyard and then into the camp of Israel and past the camp of Israel to a place outside the camp of Israel, which was a clean place. Leviticus 6:11 tells us that. "Then he must take off his garments, put on other clothes," that means non-priestly clothes, "and bring the ashes outside the camp to a ceremonially clean place." Couldn't be any dead animals there, no trash, menstruating women or something like that. You know, it just got to be, it means ceremonially clean, not hygienically clean. And so that was the ash removal process for the burnt offering. Now we go to Leviticus 6, verses 11 through 13. "Then he shall take off his garments and put on other garments." I just read that verse. "And carry the ashes outside the camp to a clean place. The fire on the altar shall be kept burning on it. It shall not go out, but the priest shall burn wood on it every morning, and he shall lay out the burnt offering on it, and offer up and smoke the fat portions of the peace offerings on it." Now you recall the peace offerings, the Lord got the fat, the high priest got the breast, the officiating priest got the right foreleg, and the offeror got all the rest of it. But the only part that was burnt on the altar apparently was the fat portions, God's portions. The other parts were kept back, put in pots, cooked in another part of the courtroom and eaten by the priest and the offerors together in a communal meal. That's the peace offering. But the fat, of course, goes up on the altar. Verse 13, "Fire shall be kept burning continually on the altar. It is not to go out." Now, when the priest carries the ashes outside the courtyard, outside the camp, to the clean place, he's got to wear other garments. That could just be ordinary daily garments as he takes off his priestly robes. Or John Gill suggests and affirms, in his opinion, that these were other priestly garments that were perhaps used or spotted or dirty. So he took up some old priestly robes to go outside. I don't think so. I think he just put on regular clothes and headed outside the camp. Now, taking these ashes out would not be physically necessary every day, not physically, but John Gill says that in his opinion, nonetheless, the priests were obligated to carry them out every day, even though it wouldn't be a lot of ashes. Every day cleans the place up by getting the ashes out of there. I don't know how he knows that. Gill is an expert in rabbinic law. Maybe it's in the rabbinic law somewhere. Now, why did the ashes have to be dumped in a clean, ceremonially clean, Levitically clean place outside the camp? Well, even though they were ashes of holy things, sacrifices, and so they needed to be put in a clean place where there are no dead carcasses, no dung, no trash, as Adam Clark says. Now, I mentioned earlier that the fat portions were put on the altar of the peace offerings. Why does God always get the fat, not just the peace offerings, but other offerings too? Why does he always get the fat? Because the fat is the best part of the animal, as in the fat of the land, the best part of the land. That's just an old-fashioned way of saying the best of. Now, this fire that never went out on the bronze altar that burned the evening and morning sacrifices, it started out miraculously from God. The fire first fell from heaven. We read that in Leviticus 9:24. Then fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the portions of fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. Well, that fire that came out from before the Lord, that could be fire from heaven, like lightning, because fire can be translated as lightning a lot. Could be a blast of fire from the Holy of Holies, but I don't think so, because that would be fire running right through the holy place, might torch everything on the way out to the bronze altar, might burn up the table of the bread of the presence, of so forth. I think it's from heaven. Now, that fire burned from its initial kindling by fire from heaven, which probably lightning, and it is highly probable that it never went out until the Babylonians destroyed the temple in 586 B.C. In other words, the Israelites traveled with that fire still burning in fire pans of some sort, and they just set the fire back up when they got to the next spot. I don't know whose opinion this is that the fire lasted that long, but if so, we're talking about from 1446 to 586 B.C., well, that's 900 years, well, almost 900 years, maybe eight and a half centuries. That's a bodaciously long burning fire. We go to Leviticus 6, verses 14 through 15. Now, this is the law of the grain offering. All right, we're switching now from guilt offering to burnt offering, and now we're going to grain offering. Now, this is the law of the grain offering. The sons of Aaron shall present it before the Lord in front of the altar. Then one of them shall lift up from it a handful of the fine flour of the grain offering with its oil and all the incense that is on the grain offering, and he shall offer it up in smoke on the altar, a soothing aroma as its memorial offering to the Lord. Now, the grain offering has all been described in chapter 2, which we've already done. The rules are repeated here in Leviticus 6. There are some few additions. Colin Delitzsch mentions those additions. Quote, the new instructions are introduced with regard to what was left and had not been burned upon the altar. The priests were to eat this as unleavened, i.e. to bake it without leaven, and to eat it in a holy place, viz. In the court of the tabernacle. So we have the priest eating the remains of the grain offering. Sounds like good bread with olive oil on top. And that's just the priest, by the way. That's not the people. The people only got to eat some of the peace offering. The priest ate the rest. They ate the rest of the sin offering and now the rest of the grain offering. Now notice that verses 21 and 23 are referring to a sin offering offered up for the priest, not for a common person, because it was entirely burnt up on the altar. In verse 22, we see this, by a permanent ordinance, it shall be entirely offered up in smoke to the Lord. If you recall, a grain offering of the people was not entirely offered up in smoke to the Lord. There was a memorial portion given to the Lord, then the rest was baked in one of three ways, in an oven, on a griddle, or in a pan, and then the priest ate what was left over. But this time, the offering is for the priest himself when the priest sins. And so, this grain offering of the priest shall be burned entirely. It shall not be eaten, as it says in verse 23. But most of the peace offerings were eaten by the priest in the courtyard for the average person. Now, notice the bread here is prepared with oil on a griddle. There's no mention of cake or pan as it is with a common person. So, that's a little distinction. The oil is the same. But notice that there was a grain offering for poor people as a sin offering. It was actually a sin offering, but it consisted of grain. And that grain offered was offered without oil. That's in Leviticus 5:11. If he is unable to afford even two turtle doves or two pigeons, he shall present as a sin offering for his sin one-tenth of an ephah. That's one omer. That's two quarts of fine flour. He shall not put oil or frankincense on it because it is a sin offering. No oil, no incense, no frankincense on the grain when it is offered as a sin offering. That's a distinction we need to keep in our minds. So to summarize the distinctions of a grain offering, if a priest offers a grain offering for himself, it's totally burnt up on the fire. If it's for other people, there's only a memorial portion to the Lord burnt up on the altar. The rest he gets to keep. He gets to cook it one of three ways, or he could keep it raw for that matter, but he could cook it three ways in an oven, on a griddle, and a pan, and then he gets to eat it spread with oil. Now we go to Leviticus 6, verses 24 through 26. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and to his sons, saying, this is the law of the sin offering. In the place where the burnt offering is slain, the sin offering shall be slain before the Lord. It is most holy. The priest who offers it for sin shall eat it. It shall be eaten in a holy place in the court of the tent of meeting." Now the sin offering is slain in the same place where the burnt offering slain, which, as we know from a different verse, Leviticus 1:11, the place of slaying of the burnt offering is to the north of the altar. Leviticus 1:11, "He shall slay it," the burnt offering, "on the side of the altar northward before the Lord." Now the sin offering is said to be most holy. That means it conveys its holiness to anything that touches it. And so whoever touches it is not supposed to do profane, ordinary stuff. Verse 26, "The priest who offers it for sin shall eat it." Again, this is for sin offerings that are not offered for himself, but for other people. "It shall be eaten in a holy place in the court of the tent of meeting." Now, when the priest eats it, this symbolizes that the priest is born the son of the offerer. And of course, Christ is our priest. He bears our sin. So the priest is bearing the sin of the offerer by eating the sin offering. Now, this is for the ordinary sin offering that was offered for people other than the high priest and the whole congregation. In that case, if you recall from chapter 4, the sin offering was not to be eaten, but to be burned outside the camp. Leviticus 4:12, "All the rest of the bull he must bring to a ceremonially clean place outside the camp to the ash heap and must burn it on a wood fire. It is to be burned at the ash heap." Leviticus 4:21, "Then he will bring the bull outside the camp and burn it." That verse 21 is for the bull of the whole congregation. He shall burn it just as he burned the first bull. That was a bull for the sins of the high priest. So sin offerings for the whole congregation for the high priest were not to be eaten, but for the people, those sin offerings were eaten. The remains of the sin offering, the part that's not the fat, is eaten in the courtyard by the priest. Now, there's a question I have here. All this sacrificing going on, all this food left over in the courtyard, is it going to be too much? Is it possible for the male priest? Women were not allowed in the courtyard, but could the priest take sin offerings, take them home for the wives and daughters? I'm not really sure of that. I'm not sure the scripture says one way or the other. It does say it shall be eaten in a holy place. Well, that leaves open, at least to me, it leaves open the possibility that it's eaten in a holy place, but not completely eaten. Leftovers could be taken home for the priest's family. And I suspect that's what's allowed, although I can't prove it. Now, Leviticus 6:29, which we'll get to in just a minute, does say every male among the priests may eat of it, but I'm assuming that's in the courtyard because women aren't allowed in the courtyard. I'm not sure the priest could not take leftovers home to his wives and daughters, to his wife and to his daughters. We go to Leviticus 6:27. "Anyone who touches its flesh," the flesh of the sin offering, "will become consecrated or holy. And when any of its blood splashes on a garment in a holy place, you shall wash what was splashed on." The holy place means in the courtyard, of course, not in the 10 by 20 cubit room inside the tabernacle, which was next to the Holy of Holies. It's not talking about that holy place. It just is in a holy place, not the holy place, but a holy place, which is the courtyard. And of course, blood is sacred. It symbolizes life. It's the integral part of the sacrificial system. You got to treat it special. You got to treat it with deference and respect and awe. You don't just let it splash on a garment. You got to wash it off. So once a priest or his sons who are offering sin offerings, once they touch that sin offering, they can't touch other things. Well, let's put it this way. Only the priest and his sons who are offering the sin offering, only they can touch things that are associated with that sin offering. For example, the flesh of the sin offering itself, the dishes to hold the pieces of the sin offering, the knives to cut the sin offering. Only the priest could touch that. This would maintain veneration for the sacrifice. But now notice the causation is running the other way, because unholy people can't touch the sin offering, but if they do, then they don't put their unholiness on the sin offering. The sin offering, because it is most holy, it transfers its holiness to the people who touch it. And so then they are not allowed to do profane things. Now, I don't know how long that the priest cannot do ordinary things after he touches the sin offering and becomes holy, or the ordinary person who does that. How long is he forbidden to go to the tabernacle to offer a sacrifice? I guess we'll have to ask the rabbis for that, because I don't know. Now, this bloody garment in the courtyard that has blood sprinkled on it and that is cleaned, it could have been washed in the laver, the famous bronze sea there at the dooryard, at the doorway in the courtyard, the doorway of the tabernacle in the courtyard, or it could have been some special room set up in the courtyard. But at any rate, that bloody garment was not to be carried out of the courtyard. This is according to Adam Gill. I don't know how he knows that, probably from his rabbinic study. He says this is to preserve the esteem and value for the blood of the sacrifice, which is a type of the blood of Christ, and I think that's probably true. We go now to Leviticus 6:28. Also, the earthenware vessel in which it, i.e. the sin offering, was boiled, this is the New American Standard Version now, boiled. Also, the earthenware vessel in which it was boiled shall be broken, and if it was boiled in a bronze vessel, then it shall be scoured and rinsed in water. First of all, the word boiled. That word can also be translated cook. For example, the same verse in a different version, the New American Bible, has a clay vessel in which it has been cooked shall thereafter be broken. If it is cooked in a bronze vessel, this shall be scoured afterwards. So here's a question. Was this cooking done without the pieces ever having been roasted on the altar? I think this is what happened. The priest, having been given the sin offering by the offeror, maybe perhaps by the way of the Levites who slaughtered it for the offeror, the priest was given the fat to put on the altar, and then the rest of the animal was given to him, and he then, after putting the fat on the altar, takes the rest of that animal in the courtyard and has himself or a Levite or somebody cook the rest of the animal in the courtyard in pots, clay and bronze vessels. And that's what it's talking about here. I don't think that the rest of the sin offering is put on the fire of the altar along with God's portion of the fat. I believe it never was. It's cooked elsewhere in the courtyard. Now, I'm not going to bet my life on that. That's just the way, from what I can read, is what happened. But at any rate, if the high priest cooked his portion in a earthen pot, the earthen pot is to be broken. Why? Well, because earthenware is porous, and it's going to soak up the pot liquor of that boiling lamb or cooking lamb, and it's thus going to retain the smell, as John Gill says, and that means it's going to make that pot unseemly to use at the next offering. But earthenware is cheap, so it's not a big deal to have to break the dishes. But if the priest's portion is cooked in a bronze vessel, I just can't stand the thought of boiling lamb. Oh my gosh, roast lamb is so good. That's why I keep wanting to say cooked, because I believe it was roasted. But however, let's say it's in a bronze, some kind of a bronze pan or pot or cooking instrument, vessel. If it's boiled or cooked in a bronze vessel, bronze is not porous, so there's no point. You don't want to throw that away. You can just wash it and get rid of all the smell and the nastiness from before. The bronze vessel is scoured, not because the vessel had been defiled by the lamb on the vessel, but actually the reverse of that. The holiness of the lamb is now passed the holiness to the vessel, and now the vessels have now become too sacred for ordinary use, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says. So now you've ruined your bronze vessel. You can't use it at home to cook veggies in. Why does the lamb send its holiness to the bronze vessel? Because the sin offering was, quote-unquote, most holy. Not just holy, but most holy, which is a technical term for this. You could, and this is my speculation, you could say that the bronze vessel has to be scoured because a sin offering was in the vessel. The sin offering bore sin, and therefore sin has become in contact with the vessel, and now your vessel is therefore ritually unclean, tainted by sin. I didn't read that anywhere. That's just my guess. But anyway, the vessel is either unclean or it's holy. It's not in a normal state because it touched that sin offering. We go now to Leviticus 6:29. Every male among the priests may eat of it. Most holy, that means the remains of the sin offering. Now, we know when it says every male among the priests, that refers to the sons of the priests as well as the priests. Leviticus 6:18 says this, all the male descendants of Aaron may partake of it as their rightful share in the oblations of the Lord perpetually throughout your generations. Whatever touches the oblations becomes sacred or most holy or becomes holy or consecrated. But anyway, going back to my main point here, all the male descendants of Aaron may partake of it. So this is just not the priests who are officially priests, but also the sons of priests who have not taken on the priesthood yet. Because after all, priests has got to feed his family. We go now to Leviticus 6:30. But no sin offering of which any of the blood is brought into the tent of meeting to make atonement in the holy place shall be eaten. Now that holy place there is talking about the 10x20 cubit place where the bread of the presence is located on the north side and the seven-branched candlestick is on the south side. That's the holy place it's talking about here. There's a golden altar at that place. And when there was a particular type of sin offering, namely the sin offering for the high priest or the sin offering for the whole congregation, not just an individual member thereof. If you're talking about that kind of sin offering, in chapter 4 we saw all this. Blood is taken, sprinkled seven times before the veil, that's in the holy place, and then smeared on the four horns of the golden altar, that's in the holy place. So that's how we identify what is being talked about here in Leviticus 6:30. No sin offering of which any of the blood is brought into the tent of meeting to make atonement in the holy place. That's talking about a sin offering for the high priest or a sin offering for the whole congregation. That sin offering shall not be eaten. It shall be burned with fire. Why? Because, as we've already seen in chapter 4, those kind of sin offerings for the high priest or for the whole congregation was a bull that's totally burned. Nothing left over. And it was actually burned outside the camp. It wasn't burned on the altar. Let me read that instead of just quoting from memory. Leviticus 4, 5-7. The anointed priest shall then take some of the bullock's blood and bring it into the meeting tent, where dipping his finger in the blood, he shall sprinkle it seven times before the Lord toward the veil of the sanctuary. The priest shall also put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of fragrant incense, which is before the Lord in the meeting tent. That's the golden altar. The rest of the book's blood he should pour out at the base of the altar of Holocaust, the bronze altar, which is at the entrance of the meeting tent. I mentioned that this bull for the high priest, this bull sin offering, was burned outside the camp, not on the altar. We see that in Leviticus 16, verse 27. But the bull of the sin offering, whose blood was brought in to make atonement in the holy place, shall be taken outside the camp, and they shall burn its hides, its flesh, and its refuse in the fire. This is referred to in Hebrews 13:11, for the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy place by the high priest as an offering for sin are burned outside the camp. Ladies and gentlemen, we have finished chapter 6 of Leviticus. We are now ready to go into chapter 7 in our next audio. This chapter will concern miscellaneous laws concerning the offerings, just like this chapter was basically. I hope you stay tuned for that one. And I hope you remember what John Calvin said about the book of Revelation. He says, if you weren't crazy when you started studying this book, you will be when you finish. I would like to apply that to the book of Leviticus. If you weren't crazy when you started studying this book, you will be by the time we finish. Hope to see you next week or next time. And I certainly hope you enjoyed this audio.